Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
And we are back. This is our second hour of Interpreter Radio. Thank you for being there. We have a wonderful discussion going on here during the break between our co-host tonight, Terry Hutchison, Professor Dan Peterson, and me, Martin Tanner. It's a pleasure to have you listening out there. During our second hour, we are going to talk about Dan Peterson's recent Interpreter Foundation article entitled How Things Look From Here. And I wanted to start off rather than talking about what's in the article, but asking you why you decided to write this, because there's always a story when an author writes something that's worthwhile about why they did it, because that's how the article came to be.
Well, there is always a backstory or stimulus for these sorts of things, and quite often it's something I see online, some criticism or something. I'm not sure there's anything particularly dramatic about this one. It's just that I saw over and over and over again the claim by some critics that, oh, well, these apologists now are fighting this sort of desperate rear guard action. They're just hoping that they can preserve some little bit of Joe Smith's yarn or Joe Smith's mythology and so on. And they realize they're losing. And they'll use examples. For example, the limited geography view model of the Book of Mormon. Supposedly, we once held to a hemispheric view, but because the evidence is so much against us, we keep shrinking the area smaller and smaller until eventually it'll be microscopic so that it can't be disproven. Of course, that's not at all true. I mean, John Sorensen explains his reasoning, which is once you read the Book of Mormon carefully and chart out the distances they travel, they don't ever go very far. It's a small area.
It fits the text.
Yeah. So it wasn't because of, well, they'll say, because DNA was threatening to eliminate the Book of Mormon. You know, the limited geographies were around before DNA was deciphered by Crick and Watson, and long before that, actually. I just wanted to respond to this idea that we're just desperate, that we get together and we're sort of weeping and sighing and thinking, oh, my word, we're on our last legs. But there's still a hope. You know, I think I quote the scene in it from Dumb and Dumber, you know. You think there's a – do I have a good chance with you? One character says to the girl, no, not really. Well, what would you say, 1 in 100? And I'd say more like 1 in 1,000,000. And he says, oh, yeah, you mean there's a chance.
There's a chance. Exactly.
And that's sort of how they think we're thinking. But I can promise you, you know, gatherings like us tonight or gatherings of the interpreter board or the conferences that we have, we're not sitting around thinking, oh, man, we may not make it till next conference.
We definitely weren't during the break, I can tell you that.
I have watched this now for long enough that I'm feeling to be a bit on the senior side of the people who see apologetics. But I remember coming home from my mission, and there was this Kingdom of the Cults book by Walter Martin, and people in the church were running around, you know, with their hair lit on fire, according to all the evangelical Christians, wondering what to do about this. And one of our friends, who was actually in here last hour, Van Hale, had a number of debates with Walter Martin. And I remember thinking, you know, this guy's not all that superb. He just sounds like somebody who really thinks he knows his stuff, and he's not that great. And then you have other critical experts who came onto the scene, you know, supposedly, and I remember doing a 3-hour stint on the radio with Gerald and Sandra Tanner, who I introduced as my thankfully distant relatives, Gerald and Sandra Tanner. And they kind of looked at me kind of funny and then burst out laughing. We actually had a pretty nice discussion, but I had sort of a backhanded compliment from your buddy who's now gone to the other side, Bill Hamblin, after it. He says, Martin, you did really well. They're not that good, are they? And so the list goes on.
Well, I remember that show, and I remember actually thinking, wow, they're not as good as I thought they would be.
Yes.
I expected something more, but the more I listened to them, the more I thought, they're not all that sharp.
They're not.
And I don't say that to mock them. No. I'm just saying they'd been sort of depicted as these kind of gigantic figures.
Yes.
I mean, just
yes.
giant slayers taking on the church.
They had a biography about him come out last year, yes. a full length.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Several hundred pages from Signature, of course.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Of course.
But they weren't that impressive.
Yeah. They're not that impressive. And you look at what's happened since Farms was founded and since the Interpreter Foundation and Book of Mormon Central and all the other centrals that are out there, if I can abbreviate them quickly like that. The scholarship that we have now is just enormous. And the people who make comments like you're describing in your book, Dan, about how we're back on our heels, those are people who read certain little websites, which are kind of like the half of one tenth of one millionth of everything that's out there, and think they know it all.
Yeah.
Because when you get right down to any of these issues, we are not losing; we are winning. As one of the more interesting evangelical publications a dozen or so years ago said.
losing the battle and yes. not knowing it. I was going to bring that up.
Perfect, yeah. Perfect. Well, talk mm-hmm. to us about.
Well, I've had a radio program down in St. George for almost 30 years. And when I do the call-in show, it's usually political, but sometimes I will get an author on. So I've had Dan Vogel on. And I remember he had just written his biography of Joseph Smith. He's got another one coming out next week that's part of their trilogy. But he was...
I think it's
he
Trinity.
Was kind of... No, this sorry, was this sorry. Was a trilogy. I could get into more details, but I won't. But he was kind of trying to portray himself as... someone from the Latter-day Saint tradition.
Oh, yeah.
And we didn't let him do that. we got him to admit that he had left the church. Yeah. Once we cleared the air on that stuff, we were able to have a valid discussion about Joseph Smith back and forth. And I took a lot of criticism for that, for even giving him the time on the air. Yeah. But I think those kind of discussions can be very valuable. I had Will Bagley on. And I remember a couple of times because Mountain Meadows Massacre, St. George, really a big thing down in St. George. And with me, he answered the questions a certain way, and we had very pleasant conversations off the air and so forth. Unfortunately for him, he came up here and did an interview and answered all of those questions 180 degrees opposite. So the next time he came down, we had a different conversation. And I just want them to be academically or intellectually honest with the audience.
Yeah.
I went after Grant Palmer once on my program, and I even mentioned him, which I rarely ever did, but I attacked him hard because of something intellectually dishonest that he did. And so I just think that as we get through, and I've seen people be critical lately, Dan, I follow you on social media, and Mike Parker, there's been a little bit of back and forth with some of the different believers in various Book of Mormon theories. Mm-hmm. And someone said, well, why are you saying anything, Dan? And I thought your response was really good. You cannot just let the argument go unresponded to. There's a certain place where, of course, the church doesn't need to, but somebody needs to stand up and take control.
Right.
And not cede the media or publicity angle to someone else.
Yeah.
It's like an example that we had with, for lack of a better word, removing inappropriate books from our school libraries. The Deseret News, shockingly, put forward an op-ed from the ACLU last year in support of keeping the books there. The Tribune ran an op-ed from an author, one of the authors we removed down in Washington County. I couldn't lay down and let that happen. So I called the papers. I said, can I respond? I'm on the board. They said yes. My board didn't want me to. Our attorneys didn't want me to. I don't care. I want to get out there. And every time you see something that is misframed in the media, in today's world, you need to respond.
Right.
Now, thankfully, Elder Anderson has given us real good counsel on that in not this conference, but the last conference about how to go about that. And I think we managed to do a pretty good job in spite of all these fake claims about ad hominem, straw man, all the name calling and everything else. But I think you cannot, when you see these things, you just can't let them go unanswered or unresponded to, because then you're just playing ostrich. And if you bury your head in the sand like an ostrich, somebody's going to come along and they're going to hurt you.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we have to try and avoid. And that's one of the things I liked about Farms, is that they stood up to whatever was going on. I like that about Interpreter. I believe there's a time and a place for certain groups or entities or institutions to be quiet, but not everybody.
Right.
And as private citizens, I think we can seize the day, if you will.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily nasty to contradict something that's not true or to deny an accusation. You don't have to do it in a vicious way.
Yeah.
You don't have to be angry about it. But it's not unrighteous to say, no, that's not true, or no, that did not happen, or you're simply wrong on that, sorry. And some people say, well, that's contentious. No, disagreement is not contention. Contentiousness is a different thing. We try to avoid that. But contradiction, telling the truth, correcting error, these are – and obviously there are times when it's – someone wrote to me the other day and said, well, aren't there times when it's better just to turn the other cheek? Sure. You know, and it's not always good to tell the truth. I mean, the question always comes up is, does this dress make me look fat? You know, I had an uncle who was absolutely proud of his unvarnished truth-telling, and he left kind of a – I liked him a lot, but there were a trail of broken bodies behind him everywhere he went, you know. My mother would come up and say, oh, you're looking fat. Are you eating like a hog? And, you know, you really didn't need to say that. Didn't need to. So, you know, that should be avoided, obviously, but I think there are times when you just have to tell the truth. Yeah.
Reprove betimes, which means at an appropriate time, with sharpness, and afterwards, the afterwards part is the important part. Let somebody know that this is not so much a personal attack as an attack on the information.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a distinction. If I say that argument is fallacious, it's not the same thing as saying you're an idiot. You know, we all of us have made bad arguments at times and realize when someone points it out, oh, that was not well done, or I need to rethink that or something. I try never to say things like, you're an idiot. I just don't do that. Now, on the other hand, sometimes
I think...
You're
a better man than I, Dan.
Well, I have been known to say it. But sometimes I think, okay, he is an idiot, but I'm not going to say it. I'm going to let this make my case, which is he's arguing X, Y, and Z. This is obviously idiotic. If the audience wants to conclude he's an idiot, I'm not going to deny it, but I won't say it. You know, but you said something that strikes me about how they're not always that good. I've had an illustration of that just the other day. I posted something on my blog just two or three days ago, I think, where I showed a picture of a hill near Veracruz in Mexico. And I said, some people think this is the original Hill Camorra, and I'm inclined to think they may be right. immediately, a whole bunch of people in a certain place on the internet who watch everything I do like a hog and comment sort of like a hawk. I say not a hog, maybe like a hog, but like a hawk. But they will respond within minutes sometimes when I post something. They immediately
it's something
began
to see, though it really
oh
is.
It is. But they immediately began going after that. What a crazy idea! You know, I just make these things up, and I thought, okay, what this tells me is something really interesting. Because the theory that hill is the Hill Camorra has been around since at least the early 80s in print. David Palmer wrote a book called In Search of Camorra. I think John Sorensen talks about it in various things he's written. It's not like I just made it up two or three days ago. What this tells me is that they often pose as if they've read all the apologetic stuff and found it wanting. But when I see that they don't even know some of the basics about apologetic literature, they clearly have not read John Sorensen or David Palmer and so on about the geography of the Book of Mormon, they aren't as good as they pretend they are.
That's right. One of my big takeaways from that discussion debate with Gerald and Sandra Tanners was that it made me never again afraid to go into a, contention or debate with critics, because I always felt I had an unfair advantage, the truth.
Yeah.
And that's the way all members of the church should see it, because one of the most fabulous statements that Joseph Smith ever made was, we embrace the truth wherever we find it. Doesn't matter where it is. If it's true, we embrace it. And so if we embrace the truth, there's nothing to ever be afraid of that someone else can say.
Right.
If it's false, you learn that it's false and discard it. And if they say something that's true, you figure it out and understand it in context, and everything will be fine. And if you have that point of view, you will never be afraid to look at something a critic wrote, because it will somehow dash your testimony. That is literally not possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I had an experience with somebody where they came to me and said, hey, Brigham Young is supposed to have said this thing. I said, well, okay, let's go take a look at the full quote, see the context. So we go, we pull it out, we look at it. Oh, this sentence is gone. Why? I said, well, you know, I have my own theories about that, especially when you're dealing with people quoting online. Yeah. They selectively edit them often. Tanners were huge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you love those ellipses where the word not is part of the
yes,
yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah. And anyway, it was an eye-opener for this person who had up till that time been really struggling to get his feet under him again with regard to Joseph Smith and the gospel and Brigham Young. After that, it was like, okay, how much of these other things have been selectively aimed at me? And so the whole point became, okay, just introduce them, but make sure you give them the whole story. Then they, of course, are going to make up their mind.
Yeah.
And it's just like you said in your article, though, Dan, we will never prove it.
Right.
Okay, but on the other hand, we will never disprove it.
Yeah.
We will have enough for people to be able to choose and make up their own minds, and that's what God intends for us to do.
You know, in the case of the Tanners, I can't remember if this is before or after your interview with them. I remember talking with you about that interview before it came, and we were sort of wondering how good would they be, and it was kind of a deflation to realize they weren't that good. At some point, I began looking seriously at one particular issue. I won't get into it. It doesn't matter so much what it was, but where they had some quotations. Well, it was about the first vision, that leaders of the church didn't seem to know about the first vision until quite late, even to the 1880s and so on. And I began looking at the quotations they had and thinking, well, these are a little problematic. Why do they not seem to be aware of the first vision that late? But then I began to get the original sources out and realized they just talked about the first vision, you know, just in the paragraph before. And I thought, oh, man, my opinion of the Tanners is sinking precipitously.
Yes. What happened to that 1832 account?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I thought, I can't believe they did this. This is too big for it to be an oversight. It wasn't just a matter of leaving out the ellipses or something. You left out a whole paragraph that turns the meaning of this passage on its head.
Yeah.
And I found several of those, and I thought, okay. I used to think, well, they're wrong, but they're honest. They're probably the best we've got out there. I just lost, and it's kind of hard to say, but I sort of lost some faith in them. You know, with that, they just weren't being as scrupulously honest as I thought they
were. You know, Dan, I too have lost faith in those anti-Mormons, those critics. Yeah.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the conversation with Dan Vogel, and I don't mean to kick Dan. I actually kind of like Dan. We see each other about once every 5 years, but we're friendly. And
maybe because you see each other every five years.
Maybe so, yeah. But I remember having that conversation with him once at an academic conference down in Southern California. He happened to be there, and he sort of latched on to me, and we were walking around, and he was saying things like, Dan, we can get along. We can be friends. You know, you're a conservative Latter-day Saint, and I'm a liberal Latter-day Saint. And he was going on like that. And I finally turned to him and said, "No, Dan, you are not a liberal Latter-day Saint. I know liberal Latter-day Saints. I know what they're like. You're a non-member. You've had your name removed. You're an atheist. You deny every claim of the Restoration. You're not a Latter-day Saint at all. You're not even in the ballpark." And let's just be clear about that. I mean, we don't need to be nasty to one another, but let's not fake who we are and where we stand. Yeah.
Well, once again, it's when you change the terms of the argument. Because, for example, being Latter-day Saint is like being Jewish. It's ethnic.
Yeah.
And once you start establishing that, okay. And I think that's where he was coming from with me, I'm from the tradition, if you will.
Yeah.
And I'm not there.
No.
I'm not there.
No.
I'm really, okay, you give me the definition you're using, and then okay, maybe it's my professional training, I don't know, but we just go with what our definitions are, and then we can have a conversation.
And when the farther you get down into the details, I have come to believe, the better the church shines.
Yeah.
If you look at some broad statement like, we've found the Joseph Smith papyri, and they don't say what the Book of Abraham says, therefore the Book of Abraham is a fraud, you think, wow, that looks pretty serious if you don't know all the details. And you can look and say, well, we found the Joseph Smith papyri, but what does that mean? We certainly haven't found all of it. And then when you look at that, you find everything that we did have that we don't have now. And then you get to that conclusion and see that it's absurd.
Yeah,
it doesn't disprove things. And the more you go down into the details, the better the church will shine every single time without question.
Well, and I guess one point that I wanted to make, and I don't know if I did make it with that article, is not only do I not feel that we're on the defensive, I think the experience that I have with my fellow apologists, is that we find the whole thing kind of exhilarating. There is new stuff coming out all the time where we think, oh, gosh, we hadn't noticed that before. That's another little bit of evidence for the truth claims of the church. Or that's a bit of depth in the doctrine or in the scripture that we hadn't noticed before. This is exciting. I mean, it's we're not on the defensive all the time, anything but. We enjoy this. In fact, I'd much rather spend my time on affirmative arguments for the truth of the gospel rather than defending against criticisms, though I think both are necessary. I mean, a football team has to play offense and defense. So
very much so. I remember the first time I read the B.H. Roberts, Problems of the Book of Mormon. I thought, oh, my word, B.H. Roberts, he's a pretty brilliant guy. You know, what's going to be, whatever he's seeing as a problem in here, and you go through it and you think, well, we figured that one out. Oh, we figured that one out, too. Oh, science is taking care of that one. And you get to the end, and virtually everything that he, with the knowledge that was available at the time, saw as a problem, they've been solved with modern scholarship.
Yeah.
And what you've mentioned, Dan, is so very true. There's just a mountain of scholarship in favor of the position of the Book of Mormon and the restored gospel that it's almost difficult to take some of the critics seriously.
Yeah, I think we're in a stronger position now than we were when I was a kid or when I was first aware of some of the issues. We're doing better now than we were, and far better than we were in the 1930s or the 19-teens or something like that. We didn't have much of anything. And so to me, the trajectory is the opposite of what the critics often suggest.
It is. I've been in a few priesthood and gospel doctrine and, you know, youth classes where I've wanted to mention some sources and comments of critics, and people say, oh, don't do that, don't do that. And I've said, look, they're going to see this stuff somewhere at some point in time. Better to know how to respond to it and where to find the answers.
Yeah.
And I'll always mention the Interpreter's website and Book of Mormon Central and FAIR, because if you just remember those sources, you can find answers to almost everything. And if you arm people with the criticisms in advance and the responses, They don't have anything left.
I remember one of my experiences, maybe the only one I've ever really had, and it was when I was fairly young, when I was sort of knocked for a loop by something I hadn't heard before. I ran across a claim that Oliver Cowdery, it was not David Whitmer, it was Oliver Cowdery, had lost his testimony, eventually denounced Joseph as a false prophet, and claimed he'd had a revelation saying the church was false. Now, I know that's true of David Whitmer, but this was about Oliver Cowdery. And I can't remember where I saw it. And I remember thinking, oh, my word, what do I make of that? Okay, I can dismiss Oliver Cowdery as sort of a loose, you know, nut or something like that. But then there's one of the three witnesses of the Book of Mormon. Can't do that very well. And then I thought, well, I wonder if anybody else has written about this. And I remember going through that period very briefly thinking, I'm all alone. Nobody has ever – this is stupid. Nobody else has ever encountered this argument. You know, I have to deal with it on my own. But that's almost never the case. And so I picked up Richard Anderson's book, Investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses, yeah, which I had already read, but I was not – thinking about that issue. Sure enough, he talks about it. He talks about this claim that Oliver denied his testimony. And he says it was in a pamphlet that was first discovered, I think, in 1904 or 1906 by the secretary of the National Anti-Mormon League, who never actually managed to produce the original. It claims to come from a printing press in Tiffin, Ohio, but there was no known printing press in Tiffin, Ohio in that year. And the thing I should have thought about was the obvious fact that Oliver Cowdery did, in fact, come back to the church, which if he received a revelation saying, don't ever come back, he wouldn't have done.
He wouldn't have done it.
And we have records of sort of the interrogation of Oliver Cowdery before his rebaptism. They asked him all sorts of questions about what he'd done during the intervening years when he'd been out of the church. They never asked him about this pamphlet for, I think, the very simple reason that it didn't exist. I think the Tanners made something of it for a while, and then to their credit, they eventually indicated they thought it was a forgery.
Well, that was one thing that they were always pretty good about, yeah, I think, yeah, was acknowledging some things. They were more intellectually honest about that,
yeah,
than you know, maybe some of the way
than
they
some
used quotes.
Yes.
But
yeah, one of
not
them,
like everybody else. There's some people that were incorrigible.
Yeah.
Yes. One along those lines that I heard or maybe saw in one pamphlet was about how Joseph Smith had eventually killed Martin Harris.
Oh.
And I thought to myself, you know, as Martin Harris was well after Joseph Smith's death up in Cache Valley, living away, I wonder what he thought of those rumors.
Yeah, Joseph Smith, who died in 1844, yeah, killed Martin Harris in 1875.
That's right. That would be quite
a feat.
An interesting thing, yeah. I never quite got to the bottom of whether somehow Martin Harris was supposed to have died before 1844 or what, but it was absurd. And, you know, you look into these things and they're pretty easy to denounce.
Well, Dan, I would just say, what do we see now as the biggest challenge for us going forward? I mean, I think it would move to a different realm. I mean, the Tanners had their own thing, and they're long gone. We have a new, more aggressive, media-oriented group, and a lot of it is funded. They have very deep pockets. They make a lot of money doing that. I mean, I'm curious how I know what your response is going to be because of some of the ways you framed interpreter projects, but we can talk about that.
Well, maybe you do. Because what I will say, I think, is this. When I first was paying attention to apologetics on my mission, after my mission, and so on, our challenge was usually evangelicals, conservative Christians,
yes,
going after us very aggressively. That continued on through the 80s, at least through the end of the 90s, I think, with Ed Decker and Ex-Mormons for Jesus and so on. I think now the chief opposition is coming from secularists. It's not coming from evangelicals. In fact, the evangelicals, Southern Baptist Convention and others, are also facing challenges. They're losing their youth in some ways to the same acids of modernity, if you will, you know, the same things that are damaging some of our kids and other people. It's not just that the church is wrong on this or that issue of biblical interpretation. It's that the Bible as a whole, religion as a whole, is a crock. And so we have the rise of the nuns, so-called. And I think that's a real issue. And we have to be agile enough to recognize that and deal with that in some ways. Does that make sense
I think
to you?
I also think that the most aggressive are those who have left the church to become that.
Yes, I think so too. Yeah. Although they're often not as knowledgeable as they think they are.
Well.
But but they can speak with some degree of authority having been there. You know, they know the lingo and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think they're much more aggressive. Of course, that's what you always find in the Book of Mormon. One of the ways in which the Book of Mormon is applicable to our time is that it's almost always the apostates who are the worst. Amalickiah has to whip up the Lamanites, who'd rather not be in another war, thank you very much. But Amalickiah, the former Nephite, goes out and leads them off to battle, revs them up. I mean, this is what often happens with apostates. They carry that vigorous opposition with them. I mean, I'm astonished at the energy that some of these people put forward. I try to imagine to myself, what would I do if I concluded the church were not true? I'd be very sad. It's the best vision of human life and destiny that I can imagine. But I'd be depressed. I'd go away. I probably wouldn't say much. But there are some people who just seem to be in a frenzy all the time. They are online all the time.
I don't know, Dan. I think I see you coming up with some empire anti-interpreter type of thing, like a Marvel supervillain or something.
Bizarro interpreter.
But I think one of the things, the docudrama and then the internet snippets from witnesses.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's the kind of thing that we have to be more foresight in producing, because in my experience, what has happened with people, they find things on the internet that are specifically designed to immediately crash their testimony of Joseph Smith. And the way that they do that is attacking his integrity by kind of fooling them into saying, well, Joseph did this or Joseph did that, or worse, it's horrible that he did this. We're in the 21st century. He was in the 19th century, but we're going to impose our cultural values on that.
Yeah.
And so I really like what has been done with the Witnesses program and putting forward in very brief things, because unfortunately, I find people don't read anymore.
No, they don't. No, that's one of the things. You know, we did the film Witnesses and then the docudrama Undaunted, Witnesses of the Book of Mormon. And they've done pretty well. But we realize there are a lot of people out there we need to approach with 5 to 11 minute videos or something like that. And so we've done a lot of those. We still have at least 2 or 3, probably 3 more coming to the Witnesses. And then we're into a new project now on Brigham Young and the succession crisis called 6 Days in August. And we're going to do something similar. I think there will be a dramatic film. I just read the script this last Tuesday for that, the preliminary script. We'll hack it to pieces and redo it a lot between now and then. But it's a good script, and we want to do some sort of docudrama, sort of accompaniment. And then we definitely do want to do the short snippets and interview experts and talk about the background and all that sort of thing. Now, at first, I didn't think that was a topic quite of the same cosmic importance
as the witnesses.
But now I've been running into people who are more and more saying, well, you know, kind of like Joseph Smith, but Brigham Young. No, I can't stand him.
I will tell you, though, that as a younger man, I kind of had that vision.
Uh-huh.
I mean, yeah, I've always had a testimony.
Yeah.
But I had this vision of Joseph was all these good things, and Brigham, well, he wasn't quite there.
Right.
And then I read Leonard Arrington's American Moses. It changed my life.
Yeah, yeah.
It changed my life in a way that made me really appreciate Brigham and the differences, of course, in their personality. I mean, when you think about it, Brigham could administrate circles around Joseph Smith. He's a better money manager. He's a better people manager, better judge of character.
Yeah.
And yet he always deferred to Joseph Smith rather than think, oh, I can do this better.
And that is one of the testimonies to me of Brigham Young's sincerity.
Yes, absolutely.
That nobody else could dress Brigham down, but Joseph could.
Yeah.
And Brigham's next question would be, what do you want me to do? You know, whatever you want me to do, Joseph,
well,
I'll do it.
One of the things that has been troubling to me, and I like saying this, but some people are uncomfortable with this this anecdote, is that, you know, Catholics believe that the Pope is infallible when he's speaking ex cathedra on some kind of a subject. But Catholics know the Pope is fallible. And Latter-day Saints have a doctrine that their leaders are fallible, but Latter-day Saints don't believe it. They just think that whatever a church leader said, yeah, and he's got to be perfect. And so if they find some flaw, it's a huge problem. And there's a difference between perfection and being chosen and inspired, right, by God. And that's something that youth need to be taught, need to understand, because it's an important doctrine. And then if they come across something that they perceive to be a flaw, they don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak.
We ought to know this. I mean, I remember something my brother told me shortly after he was called as a bishop. He said that the lowest he'd ever been in terms of his testimony was the day he was called as a bishop. Because he said, I'd always looked up to bishops. And suddenly I was one.
I thought,
my word. You know, is the church true? And he said, I was really serious about that. That just really bothered me. I thought, but I'm not like the men I've known that I've respected all my life. You know, and I can imagine becoming a member of the 12 or becoming president of the church, you've got to have a few moments where you think, you're kidding.
Yeah.
I'm now, yeah, wow, what am I going to do? But then I've heard stories from enough presidents of the church to say, well, and then I found out, no, the Lord really does speak to me. I can trust, yeah, him. I can,
yeah,
rely,
yeah,
on him.
Yeah.
You know, Heber J. Grant told a story of coming into the first meeting of the 12 after he was sustained as president of the church, and he had the name of, I think it was Richard Young, who was Brigham Young's son, written on a slip of paper, and he was going to propose him to be a new member
apostle,
of the 12.
Right?
And he said, instead, I heard the name, and I don't want to mess it up, I can't remember who it was, I'd have to look it up, who his first call was, but he said, I heard that name come out of my mouth, and I couldn't believe it, I scarcely knew him. But he says, I knew right then,
that was the
Lord, that wasn't me, and that's who the Lord wanted. And he said, Richard Young was a great man, would have made a great apostle, never was called, mm-hmm, to the 12, and he would have been just fine, but he wasn't the man the Lord had chosen for that,
yeah,
time.
Yeah. It's an important point that you can be called of God and yet not be perfect. And so we can't let the youth see little flaws as insurmountable. I can't say that enough, because that's the kind of thing that people encounter on the internet,
yeah,
about Joseph Smith, about Brigham Young, and about others. They see some flaw with, as you were talking about, Terry, hindsight 2020 vision or current cultural, mm-hmm, norms that wouldn't apply back then, and somehow throw somebody under the,
yeah,
bus. I wanted to say that I have yet to find, and I'm very confident that I never will, a single thing that Joseph Smith or Brigham Young ever wrote that shows evil or deceitful intention or some bad character,
yeah,
trait.
Yeah.
It's just not there. They were good, yeah, loving men who did the very, very best they could under very trying circumstances,
yeah,
and I just find them amazing.
There's a lot in our history that, you know, you can question. The sequel to Massacre at Mountain Meadows is out on Kindle. Hardcover should be out any time from Oxford. Rick Turley and Barbara Brown have written that. It's called Vengeance is Mine,
mm-hmm,
and it is about the aftermath.
Right.
So when that book first came out, I remember I have dealings with Oxford, and they said, well, we went back to press five times. We can't believe it. So they ordered up the sequel, and Glenn Leonard told me they were working on it, and it's taken them a long time. And,
yeah,
you know, Ron Walker died and,
right,
other things. But that event is horrific. And right early on, you see that a couple of the principals who are talking, and they are horrified by what happened. They were not there, but they kind of ordered it.
Mm-hmm.
And those kind of things. Obviously, there's a human element there for the gospel and for the church, and it's important for us to acknowledge that and recognize it and get it out. But it's like you're saying, we have to be honest about all of it and be able to put it in a context that people can't just do that.
Right.
Steve Taysom has a biography on Joseph F. Smith that'll be out next month. There are some things about Joseph F. Smith, particularly he had a very fierce temper, and he was very rough in terms of his education. I mean, part of it, his dad died before he was born, and then his mother died when he was 13 or 14, and for a while there, he was kind of lost, and apparently he was one of these that got called on a mission at a very young age by Brigham Young, and it changed his life.
Yeah.
But yet he was an utter believer in the gospel, and he wanted to build the kingdom, and all of the great things that you look at he did as president, as an apostle, as a father and a husband and all the things. Okay, let's acknowledge the weaknesses. Let's recognize them, but let's also keep them in proper context to build an important life. And I think that's an important thing sometimes that we may forget in apologetics, is that, you know, we just want the story to be told correctly, yeah, and the balance to be had, and then people can judge for themselves.
You know, I've always liked the comment that Lorenzo Snow made about having spent, I think, a few months in the Smith home, and he noticed that Joseph Smith had flaws. He didn't expand on what they were or anything, but he said, I thanked God that I saw that because it gave me hope for me that maybe I could turn out all right too, because, you know, because Joseph was a human being with, and I don't know what they were. I think Joseph may have had a little bit of a temper sometimes. I'm not sure what it was, but Lorenzo Snow saw that and wasn't dissuaded or discouraged or tempted to disbelieve at all, mm-hmm, because he recognized that the Lord works through human vessels. He always has. And you know, one of the things that made me think maybe the 6 Days in August project really was the one we ought to be doing was when I heard of these outrageous films you may have heard of that were done showing that the allegation that Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith were assassinated in Carthage jail, not by the Carthage Greys or the mob, right, but by John Taylor and Willard Richards.
Job.
It was an inside
That's
job,
right,
presumably on orders of Brigham Young.
Oh, wait a minute. I have to tell you, I'm a little in the dark about some of these kind of things, but I think I've seen echoes of that on some social media. So yeah, that was the documentary that,
yeah,
a certain group has been putting,
yep,
out.
Yep. And I had a little bit of a collision with one of them. Someone asked my opinion online on Facebook about it, and I said that my only regret was that the director and producer of the film could only be excommunicated once. And he saw that and really blew up at me. But anyway, but I'm pretty serious about it.
Yes.
That's serious stuff.
That's another Cor-Hors back, and he's, yep, got a printing press moment.
Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly
so, you know,
which
right.
I loved, actually, as a line. I'm a talk radio guy, so I'm all about
it's
it.
It's a great line.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was, you know, and I've mentioned that to a couple of historians now. We're already doing some of the background work for the 6 Days in August project. So I've interviewed Tom Alexander, the historian, and Jim Allen, who's in his 90s now, mid-90s, but is still very, very lucid and still very good. And so I interviewed him about the succession of the 12 and the mission to England and so on. And both of them I asked, okay, I've got to ask your opinion. What do you think about the claim that Brigham Young would have ordered the assassination of Joseph Smith? And they both just... I mean, it was incredulity. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. Both of them basically said the same thing. Brigham Young was so totally devoted to Joseph Smith. Never, never in a million years would he have done that.
I don't think anybody would see that. Mm-mm.
These films are sort of the modern-day equivalent of Fawn Brody's No Man Knew My History. When I first read Fawn Brody, I thought, this is really amusing. She actually reads Joseph Smith's mind. She knows his thoughts.
Yeah.
How is this possible? And then you'd snicker and then you'd think, this makes me angry because people read this and believe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now you've got, in film version, this series of events about the assassination of Joseph and Hiram by insiders. And it's not true, and it's not reading minds. It's making up facts that you cannot find in any history, diary, telling of the events from contemporaneous.
So I'm just wondering.
When I'm unhappy, I lead a sheltered life.
Oh, yeah. You need to get this film down.
I need to get out more.
this is,
you know, to me, So what are the what is the mob doing there with blackened faces? Just having their traditional June 27th summer picnic, you know, with yeah, guns and ammunition.
Yeah, they're there to watch the events.
Yeah, according to the movie, they get up there and are shocked to discover, good grief, Joseph and Hiram are already dead. What do you know?
Yeah,
we didn't have to do anything.
Yeah, we didn't have to do anything. So it's just it's insanity, I think. But I've run into a number of people who've said, "Oh yeah, it's very persuasive." And I'll give you what I've begun to realize about this. I began to hear this even from people who don't necessarily go that far, but they'll say, "You know, my wife and I have come to the conclusion that that Brigham Young was not the Lord's choice," and so. I'm saying, okay, so I want to follow this through. You believe in President Nelson, right? Yeah, we do. Okay, well, do you understand that if you cut off the apostolic succession in 1844, then every president of the church and every apostle and every person who's been called through their authority, every temple ordinance performed, has all been invalid or very questionable at the very, very least. Oh, hadn't thought about it. Yeah. But some of the people I've met, I think for them that's not a bug. It's a feature. Because it turns out they believe that President Nelson has sold out to the vaccine manufacturers and the UN and the NAACP.
Yes. Well,
and
he can be behind President Hinckley and Monson silencing President Benson.
Yeah, yeah.
We had some of that back
in
the day.
Gee.
It was worse in our area maybe than it was up here.
Probably. But, you know, for them, you say, well, you're cutting off the authority of President Nelson. Yeah. Okay. And I think, okay, this is really serious, and so it does seem to me really important to make the point, which is what I want to make, that we'll tell the dramatic story, and we're going to be fair to Sidney Rigdon and Emma Smith, and I'm not sure if I want to be frank, be fair to James Strang, but I'll try. But he won't play much of a role in the dramatic film anyway.
That's okay.
He's
write him out of the script.
Yeah. But anyway, I do think that we want to tell the story in the drama, or in the documentary rather, that the 12 were fitted for their role. I think they didn't know it, but when Brigham and Heber especially led the group out of Missouri to Illinois, they gained experience for a large scale migration, which served them in good stead a few years later. When they were over as the 12 in England, thousands of miles from Joseph, and they couldn't ask Joseph's opinion on everything, they had to lead the church. And so when the time came for the 12 to lead the church in 1844, they'd already kind of done it.
Yes.
And so they were in perfect shape, and Joseph noticed it. And again, one of the things that Brother Allen, Jim Allen, and Tom Alexander both said was that you notice the 12 changing, the status of the 12 changing when they come back from their mission in England. Joseph notices it. He begins putting authority on them, talking about them. They'd been a traveling council of missionaries. Now they have authority within the church. And he's putting them into position as the successors. That's quite clear to me. It's clear to me what he intended. And we want to tell that story.
That's a great story. That's a great story. You know, I think you're on safe ground, Dan. I've been looking for the Strang fan club on the internet for years. I'm convinced it's not there. You're probably just... Well,
there's one guy who's fine, let me have it a few times, but he says we're making a film, an anti-Strang film. And I said, no, the film probably won't even mention him. Probably won't even mention him. The documentary will. We'll have to.
Yeah. So, Dan, I was going to veer off of our topic here a little bit. You're working on a project on the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah. Yep.
Tell us a little about that, if you would.
We have about 5 minutes here.
Yeah, it's really on the Beatitudes. I've just begun to think that there's more in the Beatitudes than meets the eye at first. Part of it just comes from the fact that I read Greek, and I'm looking at it in the original language, and there are things there that I think are lost in translation. Things are always lost in translation, so you know, no language maps perfectly onto another one. So I want to bring some of those out. And then just over the years, as I've thought about these, I thought there are little mini essays that could be written on each of the Beatitudes, and then I add in Matthew 5:48, be therefore perfect, which seems to me to sort of sum up what's said there. But I'm kind of excited about just playing with almost devotional. I'm not trying to prove the church true, although there are places where I think that there are insights that can be derived from the Beatitudes that certainly are consistent with a Latter-day Saint view. in ways that, don't appear in other traditions. So that, I think, will be one little contribution. But I mean for it to be sort of, I hope, inspirational reading so that people will slow down, read them more carefully, and think, oh, my word, there's more packed into this little B, you know, blessed are the peacemakers than I had thought. What does that mean?
I mean, yeah, I've seen some of the excerpts or some of the comments you've made on your, on the post recently. I thought, you know, when Dan comes on with us, I want him to tell people about that so they can be looking because, you know, there's a little small slice that gets that on there. And I think it's a side that once again reminds us that we're not just about the defense.
Right.
We're about the offense. And I think that's also important to to share with people.
Oh, I think that's really important. Yeah, that more than anything, I read the scriptures and I'm just amazed at how much there is in them, how much you can unpack from them, and how even in our best we scratch the surface. In gospel doctrine lessons or come follow me lessons, I'm always thinking, oh, dang, I wish I had another hour or two to unpack what's here. There's just so much there that we're – and, yeah, I'm not saying I see all of it either. And each time I read it, I think, oh, my word, I hadn't noticed that. Or sometimes talking with somebody else, he's noticed something that I never had seen. And I think you're right. You're right. That is there. I just hadn't noticed it because we all come at it from different backgrounds and our life experiences will key us in to see certain things that others won't see.
Any other directions the Interpreter Foundation is headed that you – might want to share, whether in a specific sense or in a broad sense?
Well, we have a film team beginning to leave tomorrow to do a little small film project on the history of the church in the Congo. That's not main, you know, our main focus, but looked so interesting that.
Well, so when we had the birthday, we saw the excerpt from the one on the story of them looking for the group of saints. I'm still trying to find out. My wife is still trying to find out. Did they ever find him?
Well, you know,
is there a spoiler alert and we're just not going to say?
Well, it's worse than that. We've been sort of told, don't tell this story.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Tell a different story. So we're going to tell other stories.
Okay.
But I think the church wants to be really careful with that one.
With that one.
So they knew about it, and at first we had a green light, and then they said, could you just change your focus a little bit?
Well,
so
I
think
I
we won't be doing
considering
it.
Some of the political dynamics over there, I could see that.
Yeah. So, but we are looking at some really faith-promoting stories. I mean, there are stories that come out of the Congo that are the equal of anything in early church history or the church in Britain. Mass conversions, visions, dreams, all that sort of thing.
Oh, it'll be great.
It's really fun. And so we've got our first person leaves tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
Jeff Bradshaw, as a matter
I was going to say, I haven't heard from Jeff in a while, and
well,
I
he's a little busy
going over there.
Yeah, he's headed out tomorrow morning. And then our two of our filmmakers that worked on Witnesses and so on are going over, I think, this next Sunday to join him over there. And so we'll see. And it's going to be quite an adventure. It's not exactly ideal technological conditions over there in all cases for electricity and so on, but we'll do the best that we can. And so I don't know what the deadline on that will be. I know one of our goals was to have it ready for the dedication of the Lubumbashi Congo Temple, which will be, I think, next year or the year after. I can't remember, but we'll see if we make it. So that's one little thing. I'm not saying we're moving toward filmmaking more and more, but I do think that filmmaking is an important thing, and doing short online features, not always expensive and elaborate so on as these movies are, but simple short features and so on. My opinion is, frankly, we've gotten killed over the past several years by critics who've been very adept at doing that kind of thing with very low-tech stuff.
Yep.
And we've kind of ceded the field to them, and I think we shouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, well, it's the same as just the argument in the media or anything else.
Yeah.
If you give the field to the other side, they will take it.
Yeah. So I want to get more into that, and that's one direction I think we'll be moving.
Well, that'll be great. Well, we'll look forward to it. And thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And we are out of time. This has been Interpreter Radio. Daniel Peterson, Terry Hutchison, I'm Martin Tanner. Thank you for being with us. Join us again next Sunday and every Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on KTalk Media. Good night.